West Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. Hours after certifying Iran has complied with a 2-year-old international nuclear agreement, the U.S. imposed new sanctions on 18 Iranian individuals and groups. U.S. spokesperson Heather Nauert Tuesday said Tehran has violated the spirit of the deal.
Iran remains, and we all know this, one of the most dangerous threats to the United States, not only our interests here around the world, but also to regional stability. And I've got a whole list of things that we can go over here that Iran is responsible for. Their full range of activities extend far beyond the nuclear threat, and I think we are all full aware of that.
She said Tehran's malign behavior includes its ballistic missile program, support of terrorism, backing Syria's leader, hostility toward Israel, cyber attacks, and threats to maritime stability. Middle East Institute scholar Zubair Iqbal said additional sanctions will not only hamper Iran's economy, it will also benefit hardliners.
The more powerful, the ultra-conservatives, get an excuse for continuing to maintain their anti-American and anti-Western attitude. But that will mean is will weaken the new government, which has recently been re-elected.
Iran called the sanctions illegal and announced its own sanctions. Nobel Peace Laureate Malala Yousafzai continued her visit to Nigeria with a stop in Maiduguri Tuesday and nearby internally displaced camps after discussing education with the country's acting president Monday.
I asked the acting president and also the governor of Borno to declare a state of emergency for education. And I think in that there are a few things that are needed. Firstly, to increase the spending on education by 300% and also to make the spending public.
An estimated 10.5 million children are currently not in school. This is VOA News. Venezuela's foreign minister says the country is moving forward with plans to elect members of a constituent assembly despite threats of new U.S. sanctions. Samuel Moncada said the planned July 30 ballot is aimed at rewriting the Constitution and an act of political sovereignty. Nothing and nobody, he says, can stop it. Sunday, the opposition held a referendum opposed to the new assembly, in which more than 7 million people took part. Inter-American Dialogue senior fellow Peter Huckam called the timing of the U.S. sanctions threat unfortunate.
I think that this puts the United States in the position of trying to impose itself, and I don't think this is very helpful at this point.
The opposition has called for a general strike Thursday. A pro-Russian rebel leader in eastern Ukraine has proposed replacing the current country with a new federal state, an idea rejected by President Petro Poroshenko.
We are confident that we reintegrate the Donbas, we reintegrate the Crimea, and we renew sovereignty and territorial integrity, no matter what Russia said.
A Kremlin spokesman said the Russian government was not consulted about the rebel announcement. The declaration appears to cast a shadow over the Minsk peace agreement, which has so far failed to quell 3 years of fighting. Tensions persist between Muslim worshippers and Israel over the installation of metal detectors and cameras at entrances to the Noble Sanctuary Temple Mount complex in Jerusalem after three Israeli Arabs killed two policemen last week. Mickey Rosenfeld is an Israeli police spokesman.
The security measures in and around the Old City of Jerusalem are continuing in order to make sure that there are no further terrorist attacks that are taking place.
Palestinian protesters clashed with police during Muslim evening prayers Tuesday. Lebanon's Prime Minister Saad al-Hariri Tuesday said his army will carry out an operation along the Syrian border used by a base for militants involved in the Syrian civil war. Amnesty International urged Beirut to be careful of crowded refugee camps in the barren mountainous region known as Jerad Arsal. The top UN aid chief has told Reuters spiraling violence in Central African Republic could plunge the country into a large-scale humanitarian crisis. Stephen O'Brien pointed to a surge in fighting between rival militia that has uprooted tens of thousands since April. In the Philippines, four members of the Presidential Security Unit were wounded Wednesday in a firefight with Maoist rebels disguised as soldiers at a checkpoint on Mindanao Island. President Rodrigo Duterte was not in the region at the time. The clash occurred a day after he called on Congress to extend martial law on the island to year's end. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, July 19th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Angola says no to European Union election observers' demand.
The European team had called for unfettered access to polling stations during the August 23 vote, but Minister George Cicotti saying that we do not expect anyone to impose on us their means of observing the elections.
Mario Alpaiva is a veteran Angolan journalist. With Monday's failed vice presidential debate, Kenyans are hoping their two main presidential candidates will square off next Monday. South Sudan president declares a state of emergency in his home state, and the United Nations says an upsurge in violence is causing thousands to flee Central African Republic.
Our colleagues who were in Dou a few days ago say the situation there is chaotic and its proximity to the border makes it dangerous, with armed bandits feared to be nearby.
William Spindler, a spokesman for UNHCR, Burundi reports a new uptake in grenade attacks around the country, and Zimbabwe temporarily lifts a ban on plastic foam food containers. Those stories plus our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. As Angola prepares for its August 23rd presidential election, it seems a row is developing with the European Union over election observers. The EU had said it wants unrestricted access to all 18 polling stations across the country. The main opposition UNITA party has alleged irregularities in the operation of the Elections Commission. 74-year-old President José Eduardo dos Santos, in power since 1979, announced this year he would not seek another term. Veteran Angolan journalist Mario Alpaiva says the Angolan government has told the European Union it does not want outsiders lecturing Angola how to run its election. Angola also said it only has election observation agreement with two organizations, the African Union and the Southern African Development Community, SADC.
The matter of the situation is that Angola has rejected the condition demanded by European Union election observer mission that had been preparing to witness next month's polls in the country. The European team had called for unfettered access to polling stations during the August 23 vote, but Minister George Cicotti told to the official newspaper daily, Journal de Angola, saying that, "So this is Africa, and we do not expect anyone to impose on us their means of observing the elections or to give lectures." The minister also adds that the invitation stands, but we, I'm quoting the minister, do not want to have separate agreements with all of the organizations.
Is the government afraid? Because if you don't have anything to hide, you can let the European Union observers have access to the polling stations.
The government says they can come. They can go to wherever they want. But the point of the matter is that the government are saying is that there's no need for a special agreement with the European Union, because the only official agreements in terms of electoral observer missions are with the African Union and SADC, the Southern Africa Development Community. So we are not clear that the European Union are still coming. But after this statement of the Angolan government, the most important opposition parties are criticizing the government of lack of enough transparency on the electoral process.
Mario, what can you tell us about this constitutional court ruling regarding civil society organizations?
Yes. In fact, the constitutional court make a statement saying that President dos Santos' demand to rule on non-governmental organizations was unconstitutional because it is against the constitutions, which allows freedom of expression, freedom of speech, and all different kinds of human rights, like freedom of organizations. From the civil society side, it was considered a victory, but some activists, some people at non-governmental organizations are saying it was just a, a charming maneuver from the government just before the August general elections. And so they really don't trust too much this kind of fashions. So we will see, especially after the elections, how the things will go with the civil society organizations. Because in the past, we experienced in Angola several problems with the intimidations, some of the tensions of activists, limitations. It happens, I can remember that the bank accounts of some civil society organizations were blocked by the government at that time. So we will see, especially after the elections, how it works.
When President Dos Santos signed the decree, he said he was doing so because he wanted to fight some non-governmental organizations that were involved in criminal acts, such as money laundering. How true is it that these organizations do that?
Not really. So this was from 2014, more or less 3 years ago. What the activists, human rights and civil society activists are saying, the aim of this law was to target some civil society organizations, special the ones which has been denouncing human rights violations. I could give an example, for instance, Omunga, which is based in Benguela province, which has been promoting human rights, special for rural people, etc., experiences the blocking of their bank accounts. And this was, according to activists, just an argument to block the organizations which has been denouncing the human rights violations from the government side.
Mario, thank you always. It's so nice to talk with you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, James.
Mario Alpaiva is a veteran Angolan journalist. He was speaking with me from the capital, Luanda. With Monday's failed vice presidential televised debate, Kenyans are hoping their two main presidential candidates, incumbent Uhuru Kenyatta and challenger Raila Odinga, will square off next Monday. Their running mates, William Ruto and Kalonzo Musyoka, did not take part in Monday's debate, leaving only one candidate to take questions from the debate moderators. Political reporter Patrick Langat of the Daily Nation newspaper says consultations are going on between debate organizers and the two leading presidential candidates to ensure the debate takes place.
The Debate Media Limited has insisted that they planned debate for presidential candidates on July 24th would still happen. We understand that the organization is now doing further consultations with the presidential candidates to ensure that what happened on 17th with the running mates does not happen and that the presidential candidates actually do turn up for the debate.
Do you think the candidates really want to debate, or is this the sign of the political climate in the country?
The two leading presidential candidates, that's President Uhuru Kenyatta and Raila Odinga, have been involved in a push and pull, really, on these debates almost since after they were announced, with the National Super Alliance, that is the coalition supporting Raila Odinga, former Prime Minister, insisting that they were ready to debate President Uhuru Kenyatta, but insisted that he must turn up for such a debate to be fruitful. The President Uhuru Kenyatta side, on the other hand, there has not been any formal communication from his part. But his handlers, most of his handlers on social media platforms, have said that he won't attend the debates on Monday and that he would be engaging with Kenyans directly in rallies, in town hall meetings, but he won't attend the debates directly. We understand that even with such comments from his handlers and from people close to him, with no formal communication, the Debates Media Limited has been reaching out to these people to get a formal agreement from these people that they would show up. But with the insistence that even if they don't, the planned debate for July 24th for the presidential candidates would still go.
Overall, what are Kenyans saying? What is their view on the ground? Do you think most Kenyans are in favor of seeing these two candidates debate?
Personally, I would say yes. That people are really, judging from the comments that came out of the fact that the presidential candidate debate did not happen, judging from the comments that came from that. You would say that Kenyans are starting to react to this kind of debates, this kind of forums where candidates have relayed manifestos, their ideas to the people in a town hall format, in an organized format, as opposed to political rallies where they have. Judging from those comments, I think Kenyans are in favor of a debate between the two leading presidential candidates.
Patrick, it's so nice to talk with you, and thank you very much as usual. Patrick Langat is a political reporter for the Daily Nation newspaper. He was speaking with me from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. Today's Wednesday, July 19th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butt in Washington, and please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is 16 minutes past the hour. UN agencies say an upsurge in violence and an alarming escalation of human rights abuses in Central African Republic are causing tens of thousands of people to flee across borders and thousands more to become displaced within the country. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The United Nations says the violence taking place in Central African Republic is on a scale that has not been seen since 2014. This is affirmed by agencies such as the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, which notes more than 100,000 refugees from CAR were registered in Democratic Republic of Congo by the end of June. Additionally, the UNHCR reports that DRC authorities have registered more than 60,000 new arrivals in North Ubangi and Bauele since May. UNHCR spokesman William Spindler says people have been fleeing into remote areas of northern DRC. This is putting immense pressure on difficult-to-reach local communities that are close to the border. Spindler says one of these areas is Ndu. While barely a village, he says Ndu now is hosting some 37,000 new arrivals from CAR.
Our colleagues who were in Ndu a few days ago say the situation there is chaotic and its proximity to the border makes it dangerous, with armed bandits feared to be nearby. Refugees are staying everywhere they can, in churches, buildings used as schools, in the only health center, or sleeping in the open. People desperately need more healthcare, food, and shelter.
In the meantime, the UN Children's Fund reports that children increasingly are being targeted by armed groups in CAR during attacks on villages or towns. It says atrocities committed against children as young as two include murders, abductions, rape, and recruitment as child soldiers. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The Burundian government says there has been an uptick in grenade attacks throughout the country in the last 3 months, leading to the deaths of more than 10 people. Moses Havyarimana reports from Bujumbura.
Some stability is gradually returning to Burundi following the 2015 political crisis brought about when President Pierre Nkurunziza decided to seek another term, something the opposition criticized as a violation of the constitution. Since then, more than 500 people were killed, but the Burundi government said the crime rate reduced by 32% in the last 3 months. Alain Guillaume Bunyoni is the Burundi Minister of Public Security.
During this term, the security situation has continued to improve, and it is globally good throughout the country. However, we deploy cases of ordinary crimes. We noted as well cases of grenade throwing and terrorist acts in some localities of Bujumbura municipality.
There have been several grenade attacks nationwide over the last few weeks, mostly targeting public places and government officials. At least 10 people have been killed from grenade attacks in the last 2 months and more than 70 injured. Burundi Public Security Minister Alain Bunyoni says searches are being conducted countrywide in efforts to find what he called illegal weapons in civilian hands.
The police made 3,561 searches all over the country. So the National Police of Burundi seized through those searches 43 weapons. Police were able also to dismantle 48 bands of criminals and to apprehend 1,212 criminals.
Meanwhile, the police say they have impounded 150 vehicles in the capital as part of the efforts to curb insecurity that has hit the country in the last 3 months. Pierre Nkurikiye is the police spokesman.
According to the investigation, people who made the second attack here in Ibuiza is also the one who made the first attack on the police. And they used a car, normally these cars that are used committing criminal acts, and more than 150 cars are seized by the police. Because police now discover that same cars that are used in different criminal acts.
Roadblocks and checkpoints are seen on the streets and highways of Burundi to maintain stability in the country. The Burundi National Human Rights Council said recently that human rights abuses in the country had decreased, but forced disappearances throughout the country are still being reported. Moses Havyarimana, VOA Africa, Bujumbura.
South Sudan President Salva Kiir has declared a state of emergency for 3 months in his home state of Gogria, where clashes have raged for months between clan-based militias. Information Minister Michael Makuei told Reuters news agency that the South Sudan Army will be given powers to stop the fighting in Gogria and that citizens' rights will be suspended. Civil society activists fear the move will hinder the work of humanitarian workers operating in the areas. They also said it contradicts the spirit of the national dialogue launched by President Kiir. Nabil Biagio reports from Juba.
Rajab Mohandes, executive director of the Juba-based civil society group South Sudanese Network for Democracy and Elections, says calling for a state of emergency in Greater Bahar Ghazal will embolden soldiers to take matters into their own hands.
The state of emergency brings in restrictions, gives more powers to the government to take steps that may not be necessarily prescribed in the law. This is likely to affect the rights of citizens in those locations. It is likely to limit the enjoyment of their rights in every sense.
Mohandes believes the decision to place 4 states under emergency laws was prompted by intercommunal violence and a general state of insecurity.
In those areas where the state of emergency has been declared, people are dying of intercommunal violence. And when you look at other parts of the country, people die of other different causes. People die of hunger, people die of attacks on the roads and so on. So it is generally a situation that is all over the country.
And Mohandes says the state of emergency declaration will not end insecurity and instability across the country. He says what South Sudan needs is not piecemeal solutions, but rather a comprehensive one that addresses the general state of insecurity and the country's economic crisis. Bongiri Peter, executive director of the civil society group Humanity South Sudan, says the government must ensure that the state of emergency does not impede the work of humanitarian agencies working to provide food and health care to those in need.
Some of the restrictions must not go to impede the work of humanitarian organizations and agencies that are delivering services there, because the curfew might go to all sectors, and sometimes it's going to be very difficult for people who are working on the area of service delivery.
Melania Ito, who works for the Solidarity for Women's Rights Association, or SOWA, says the declaration of the state of emergency in Bahar Ghazal is ill-timed.
Currently, we are heading for the issue of national dialogue. As a civil society organization, it will affect some of our colleagues who are working in the area. They will be affected because they are not going to have enough freedom of movement, enough freedom of speech, as you know that some people take it in a wrong way.
The government did not say if or when curfews would go into effect in the designated areas, or describe other rules under the emergency declaration. But the government in Juba is expected to send additional soldiers to the 4 states. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio in Juba.
Zimbabwe's Environmental Management Agency has temporarily lifted its ban on the use of plastic foam food containers to allow businesses to clear their stocks. Sebastian Mofu reports from Harare.
Zimbabwe's Environmental Management Agency says it has given businesses until October 17 to stop using containers made of expanded polystyrene and replace them with recyclable or biodegradable ones. The reprieve follows an outcry from businesses last week when the government body imposed an immediate ban of EPS, also known as Carelite. Environmental Management Agency spokesman Steady Kangata explains.
The ban still stands, but it was only a reprieve of 3 months that was given just to allow industry and businesses to wind up. It is also again in line with the principles of natural justice, just to allow them and give them time to mop up their Carelite. But furthermore, there are conditions that they were given that they are supposed within 3 months to initiate waste management programs that would ensure that the environment is clean, not that Carelite will be seen strewn all over.
The EPS containers are among the garbage clogging drainage in Harare and contributing to flooding. The government also says EPS emits toxic chemicals when the containers are burned, and garbage is routinely burned in Zimbabwe. Environmentalists in Zimbabwe are applauding the ban, but say the government has not gone nearly far enough. Other African countries, including most recently Kenya, have banned the use of plastic bags. The president of the Confederation of Zimbabwe Retailers, Denford Mutashu, welcomes the three-month reprieve given to his members.
It's not enough, but at least it's a breathing space, and there are some companies that have invested into the production of Carelite. We will also be helping them to lobby through the government to ensure that they also get a reprieve, because it's not easy for someone to bring their machinery here and then two years down the line they're asked to move out or to stop production. So this is a serious area of concern.
But the Environmental Management Agency maintains that the law under which the ban of EPS is being effected was enacted in 2012, and businesses had enough time to switch to other food packages or ask their customers to sit while eating instead of using EPS. When the reprieve ends, the government says anyone found breaking the EPS ban could be fined from $30 to $5,000. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. As Angola prepares for its August 23rd presidential election, it seems a row is developing with the European Union over the election observers. The EU had said it wants unrestricted access to all 18 polling stations across the country. But the Angolan government has told the European Union it does not want outsiders lecturing Angola how to run its election. And that's it for this Wednesday, July 19th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Samson O'Malley, along with our engineer Jimmy Cook, I'm James Barton in Washington saying, have a nice day, Africa.
Hello, Africa. This is Peter Clotty, host of VOA's Africa Weekend show, Nightline Africa. Tune in. You will be glad you did.
Nightline Africa is a fast-paced, tightly edited news show designed to keep our listeners engaged from beginning to end. Nightline comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies: 6080 kHz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kHz, 19.2 meter band. When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
VOAAfrica.com.
News, features, music from Africa and around the world. You want it? We have it on VOAAfrica.com.
VOAAfrica.com.